You are Locked On Rockets, your daily Houston Rockets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome in to another new episode of Locked On Rockets, your home for daily podcast commentary on Houston Rockets basketball. As always, I'm your host, Ben Dubose, Rockets correspondent with Sports Talk 790, the team's official radio flagship in Houston. As we chat this Tuesday night, the Rockets are now in the middle of a rare and well-deserved off-stretch, next in action on Thursday night in Utah. They're now 24 hours removed, of course, from a disappointing 103-91 loss in Minneapolis, which largely mimicked the season as a whole in terms of its extremes. In case you missed it, and yes, we had a recap last night, the Rockets were up by 19 in the second quarter, but went on to lose by 12. That's literally a swing of more than 30 points in less than three quarters of basketball. And really, it's that type of roller coaster ride that I think we should be used to by now. After starting 4-7, I think you all know the story. The Rockets won 5 in a row, then they lost the next 4, and well, this past weekend, they won 2 in a row by an average of more than 20 points per game. That led many of us, including myself, to believe that they were again on the right track, only to seemingly run out of gas in Minneapolis when they scored just 29 points in the second half and 9 in the fourth quarter after scoring 62 in the first half. Part of it, of course, is fatigue. The Rockets just finished up a 7 games and 11 night stretch and a 3 and 4 night stretch, and that's a lot even for a healthy NBA team to go through, let alone one that's thin to begin with and had injuries to Chris Paul, Gerald Green, and Nene to deal with. And they still don't have Brandon Knight back either, even though CP3, Gerald, and Nene have returned over the past few games. But clearly, considering the Rockets are 11-12, that's below 500 through 23 games over a quarter of the way through the season, there are clearly other factors to blame besides mere scheduling. So, with the Rockets finally in an extended off-stretch and now beyond the quarter pole of the season, I figure this is a good time to sort of hit the reset button and talk about some of the issues that we've learned so far, both with the team as a whole, the recent struggles of Chris Paul, and also what roster moves they could potentially make to help dig themselves out of this mess. So to contextualize everything, I'm going to be joined momentarily by my old friend Karthik Prasad, who you know on Twitter as @StanfordKP. We've had him on the show several times before, so many of our listeners should be familiar with Karthik already, but for those who aren't, I view him as one of the best big-picture thinkers of any Rockets follower I know. So with that in mind, let's get him connected on this Tuesday off day right here at Locked On Rockets. Karthik, how are you, my friend?
Good. Great to be back, Ben.
Absolutely thrilled to have you on, as always. And I spent the first couple of minutes of the podcast briefing everyone about the last couple of games. But I figure with you, this is a point in which we can look, with the Rockets in the middle of a multi-day off stretch, at the season as a whole. Because through 23 games, 11-12, clearly it's below expectations. Yet it's below expectations, at least to me, in a weird way. In that when I think of teams perceived to be championship contenders that are inexplicably flirting with 500, I think of an analogy that you made last night, which was to the LeBron James Cleveland Cavaliers team to the past few years, which flirted with 50 wins in the Eastern Conference, and that's probably a barely better than 500 type team in the West. Yet that isn't really what's happened with the Rockets. It's not like they're not taking the game seriously. We have seen stretches, even against bad opponents, where they've looked dominant. They won the 2 games this past weekend by nearly an average of 25 points per game. So it's not like they're just not taking the game seriously. It's not like they're uninspired. They have moments of brilliance, and then they're just rapidly followed, like the 5-game winning streak, by the 4-game losing streak, and then the 2 big wins, and then whatever happened last night, going from 62 in the first half to 29 in the second. So it's a weird thing in that you look at an 11-12 team and you wonder, well, are they too injured? Are there chemistry problems? Are they uninspired after coming so close a year ago? Is there a hangover? Those are things that you would normally think, but to me, it's hard to really make sense of because there are high points that you don't really associate with a team that's uninspired. How do you view it, just trying to make sense of a team that has so many highs, yet also just some inexplicable lows, and ultimately the end result is 11-12 below 500 through 23 games?
Yeah, no, I think it's a good question. I'm, as you know, generally more optimistic, but my view on this is that if you just look at the team's priorities, and by team I mean the players on the roster, their priorities, you know, at least at the top, have to be health and probably some form of learning to play together. And then I think the actual end result of the game is probably the third priority. And what I mean by that is, like, they know they have new guys. They know their depth has been tested. And so I think what they're trying to do is just make sure they stay healthy and learn how to play together. And if they win, great, and that's what they think should happen most of the time. But there's going to be stretches where it just doesn't happen. And so for me, I look at it as they're going for the process and making sure that they're playing the right way, or at least when they can, and trying to stay healthy. And whatever the end results are, they are. But I would agree that it's been a little bizarre to kind of see some of the differences in the levels of play. But overall, though, I've seen a lot of encouraging things in the weeds of how they're playing together that make me at least optimistic for the future.
What are the encouraging things that you see? Let's follow up on that. Because I think for a lot of Rockets fans, it's one of those things, they can't escape the record, because even though they started 4-7, even though the recent four-game losing streak had a lot to do with Chris Paul, Gerald Green, Nene, Brandon Knight all being out at the same time, at some point, even one loss feels like a ton of losses just because of the overall record. So I think there is a dynamic of not being able to see the forest for the trees. What are the things that you see that, you know, have you optimistic that they could conceivably go on a run?
I would say there's at least three. The first has been the continued growth of Clint Capela. I think he's showing a level of consistency and activity, especially probably in the last 10 games or so, that we expected a little too right from the get-go. But as he's gotten back into shape and gotten over his early season injury, I think he's taken another step. So I'm optimistic there. The second thing is how they're starting to use their new wing pieces. So a guy like James Ennis, who's now, you know, doing a lot more backside cuts on offense, taking the ball to the rim. I think he's starting to grow himself as well and figuring out his role. But I think, you know, come playoff time, whether he ends up still starting or coming off the bench, like, being able to know his role and actually contribute offensively is something I'm encouraged by. And then third, you know, just Eric Gordon returning to form and showing and reminding us how good he is and can be. And I think, you know, that to me feels like he will be a better player over the rest of the season than he showed in the first 2-3 weeks while he was going through his major slump. And so you take those three things together and say, in the playoffs, if Clint Capela takes a step, if Eric Gordon is still really good, and if Ennis, whether as a starter or a bench player, can be a contributor in a solid way, that's going to help us. Now, I mean, does this roster still have holes? Do we still have to fix some depth issues? Yeah. But those three things, you know, combined with Harden being back to his MVP form, I should say, have me optimistic. And, of course, there's this whole thing around Chris Paul, which I know we'll get into. But at least from an optimism standpoint, that's where I'm at.
Yeah, I want to dig into the Chris Paul situation, because that's clearly at the other end of the spectrum. After last night's game, the clunker, 1 of 8, 5 points, 7 assists, 5 turnovers, he's now posting career worst figures in box plus minus, win shares per 48 minutes, player efficiency rating, assist percentage, career high in turnovers, and also a career low at the moment in field goal percentage. So the start to the year, it's been below his standard without a doubt. But in a weird way, it's for a different reason. It's a similar dynamic to why I'm not as discouraged about the team as a whole. The fact that his highs have been so high, that leaves me somewhat optimistic, because when I think of a player, and of course the fear with Chris Paul, he's 33 years old, he's year 14, he just got the big contract, is he washed, as Twitter would say. The reason I don't really buy into that, when you look at a player who ages and is kind of on the downhill slide, the way it typically happens is like what clearly occurred the last 2 years in New York and Oklahoma City with Carmelo Anthony. It's not like they fall off the cliff. There's just sort of a slow erosion. They're slightly less efficient because they're not getting as much separation. With Chris Paul, the highs have been so high and the lows have been so low, it makes me wonder, if there's an injury component. Early in the year, we know he had to deal with his elbow. He had that wrapped, his shooting elbow, that is. Recently, he had the hamstring issue, and then he came off the shelf for the hamstring issue, but then immediately was thrust into a 3-game and 4-night stretch, last night being the end of it. So while you can certainly point to the fact that a 33-year-old Chris Paul is injury-prone, and certainly these are not going to be the only nicks and bumps he gets over the course of the year, I'm not ready to believe just yet that there's an overall erosion of his talent relative to what we saw last April and May. The fact that the highs have been as high as they are, that doesn't really fit the profile to me of a guy who's clearly lost a step relative to a few months ago. It more, to me, suggests that he's been dealing with a few injuries that account for the overall variance in his level of play. That might be the optimist in me speaking, but it just doesn't scream to me his profile, a guy who is, you know, on the normal downhill slide of the aging curve. Just curious what you assess of, you know, the data you've seen and also the eye test of how he's moving around on the court.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's some combination of he's not maybe fully 100%. I think we can say that. You know, he's had enough injuries and he's missed enough time where I don't think he's where he wants to be health-wise, but he's at least able to play. And to me, the reason I'm optimistic about this situation, too, is that there's a solution. The solution is to get more guard depth and, you know, a second point guard that can spell him, whether within the game or if he needs to rest a few games every now and then. And so in doing so, I think will help him play less minutes overall, because right now he's averaging like almost 34 minutes, I think, when he has been back. And your point earlier, he hasn't really had the time to get back in rhythm in a sustainable fashion. He's kind of been thrown back in the fire every time he heals up. And so having more guard depth, and whether that's Brandon Knight or another player that we trade him for, I think will help Chris, you know, having more kind of flat or less variant game-to-game play, and then be able to, when he needs to, tap into that extra gear to when he needs to. So that's how I'm thinking about it, which is, if can we improve the depth such that he can focus on the defensive side, on playmaking, and when he needs to, scoring? Because I think, as a bunch of Rockets Twitter was talking about, like, relying on him to score 17 to 20 points every night, you know, especially without the depth, especially when he hasn't had time to fully heal, is asking for some of these really highs, but also really lows.
One of the interesting takes that I saw from early in the year from Red94 on Twitter, and I largely agree with it, is that part of the Rockets' willingness to go as far as they were in the offers for Jimmy Butler was built not just around this year, but the idea that down the line, maybe it's not a requirement right now, but that as Chris Paul ages and gets into his mid to late 30s, that you may need to see him go to less of a facilitating role as the clear number two that he is to James Harden right now, to more of a traditional floor general, and bring in a second isolation-heavy creator that can relieve some of the playmaking burden from Harden. Maybe that guy isn't out there for the Rockets to acquire this year after missing on Butler. We'll have to wait and see on that. The Rockets, any bigger moves, I think, would have to wait until February, getting closer to the trade deadline. But I know you're thinking bigger picture. Is that something that you agree with, that the Rockets to address whenever the aging curve does inevitably catch up with Chris to some degree, even if it hasn't just yet, do you need another star eventually to help kind of bridge the gap into the mid to late 30s portion and the finish of his career, most likely?
I mean, ideally, yes, but I don't know if it's a requirement.
Okay.
To me, what the requirement is another scoring guard, and not necessarily a shooter, but someone who can break down the defense and score. And I always make the comp of this team, at least in some form or fashion, to that 2011 Maverick team. They had Jason Terry, J.J. Barea, and Dirk Nowitzki, who could carry the scoring load, and Jason Kidd, who was aging at the time, and was a similar age to Chris Paul when they acquired him, was able to play multiple roles. And it didn't have to be the guy who had to score and create a ton of offense every night. He could do whatever was needed and be really good at it. And I think that we're missing right now that fourth or that third scorer slash fourth guard, if you will. And that's what puts kind of this extra burden on Chris Paul. And that's why, you know, whether it's Knight or whoever we acquire, that I think that role is going to be really important down the stretch.
I want to spin it forward to what the Rockets can do with the remainder of the roster, because what we were talking about in the last question, I clearly don't think that anything is on the immediate horizon in terms of a move of significant magnitude. But clearly, smaller moves can be made starting, especially, I'd say, December 15th. And who knows, maybe even before then. December 15th, of course, serves as the unofficial start to NBA trading season, because that's when guys who signed off-season contracts can be dealt. Of course, that includes Michael Carter-Williams and Carmelo Anthony in Houston. But really, around the league, it's an important date, because that's the point at which there's no more reason to wait it out and play the leverage game. Everybody can offer most of the tools, if not all, at their disposal, and the Rockets are just a week and a half away from that date right now. So we're getting close to a period in which Daryl Morey can actually do some things to upgrade the depth, which I think we can all agree has clearly plagued the Rockets this season. This afternoon, there were a couple of interesting news, and who knows, by the time you're listening, maybe there will be clarity. As the time we're recording this, Tuesday evening, there's yet to be the Rockets waiving Daniel House and also assigning Isaiah Hartenstein to the G League. Now, I think assigning Hartenstein to the G League is more just a reflection of Nene being back. They want Hartenstein because he's still developing. It's the same as Joe Chi. Now that he's not going to play with Nene back, they'd rather him get some reps whenever he can. With House, it's interesting because House has played pretty well with the Rockets, and according to both Mark Berman and Jonathan Fagan, the Rockets have interest in bringing him back. It's just a matter of giving him most likely a two-way contract. So the most plausible explanation, they could convert Gary Clark, who's been on a two-way contract, to a regular deal, but it's not a given because Clark recently has fallen out of the rotation, or they could be freeing up a roster spot for a potential move. Again, as we're recording this Tuesday night, we're still in a waiting pattern to see exactly what the Rockets are trying to do by freeing up that roster spot by waiving House. According to Berman and Fagan, the Rockets do intend on re-signing House and bringing him back. It's not like they're disappointed in him. There's just clearly some other shoe to drop, be it converting Gary Clark to the roster spot or some other outside signing or trade. But, Karthik, as we're chatting again about 7 o'clock Tuesday evening, just your thoughts when you saw that report on the wire and what the possibilities are running through your mind that the Rockets may do and why they might, you know, waive a guy at least for a few hours in Daniel House that at face value has been a pretty quality contributor for you over the past week.
Yeah, to me, I think this is more about the Gary Clark situation as we talked about. Because, you know, we've looked at, and I think that Rockets Twitter has broadly discussed, you know, the many options that could be on the table in terms of small moves to improve the roster. And a lot of them have to do with a post-December 15th type of timeline in terms of getting all of our kind of smaller contracts together and trying to get a wing or a stretch forward that could upgrade the roster. And so I don't think that anything is necessarily going to happen soon, as you talked about. And so my head is that, you know, this is about Clark. But that being said, I mean, I think there is a broader question on how they use those contracts and when they use them. And I think they have, the good news to me is that they have a lot of flexibility in terms of how those contracts are broken up. They can add different pieces here and there to get different types of players. And so I'm excited to see how that plays out. But to me, that it starts with December 15th because a lot of those pieces are able to be moved then.
If you could, in whatever outside acquisition occurs, if there's one position that you could target, I think we can all agree that clearly the Rockets' depth falls off a cliff after about the 9 or 10 spot on the roster, which is why anytime there's just one or two injuries, it feels like the team's production as a whole plummets, because then, of course, the bench gets compromised, and you also overextend the starters, which makes them prone to defensive lapses, turnovers. We've talked about this ad nauseum. Mike D'Antoni has as well. One issue that I keep coming back to more and more is the rebounding. We saw it late in the second half against the Timberwolves last night. Of course, that was a 3-4 night stretch, but the season as a whole, they consistently have been near the bottom of the league in defensive rebounding rate. I'm not necessarily saying that they need another big, but in my opinion, it would help if the outside shooter that you mentioned was also able to chip in on the glass in a way that, you know, maybe Trevor Ariza was last year, and James Ennis, at least to this point in the year, has not done as well. Is that a need as you see it, Or even is there need? Because you could also make the argument, especially with Brandon Knight coming back, that it's less about any one position and it's more about they just need a body, a rotation quality player, wherever they can find it. I'm just curious if there's just a specific thing that you're looking for or if you're just true BPA, best player available.
I think I'm in the, if I had to order the wish list, it would be a backup to PJ Tucker, someone that can do the things that he can do in a similar way. I mean, maybe not as good. And that's when you think about a guy like Marvin Williams. And so the reason I go to a bigger guy, someone who's more of a stretch four, can play a small ball center, but also switch on the threes in the perimeter, is because I think, for two reasons. One, we need, like, PJ's playing way too many minutes, and he's so vital to what we're trying to do in the playoffs that we have to provide him some relief. Number two, I think, to your point about this size element, that, to me, plays out in two ways. First, it's on the defensive rebounding glass, where we've somehow taken a step back. But then, second, on switching. I think the counter that a lot of teams have made to our switching scheme is to slip the pick and roll and then get a big right at the rim so that he can finish on a smaller defender. And if we have one more kind of switchable guy but who has a bit more size, I think that will help us counter those type of moves. And you think about a team like the Clippers, who when they switch and dump it down to Montrezl Harrell and he abuses our smaller wing defenders, like if we had someone who was more 6'9", 6'10", has a bit of height and weight to combat those switches, I think that's a need for us on the defensive end and will help also on the defensive glass. So that's where I look at a guy who's more of a four who can still switch, you know, 2 through 5, mm-hmm. and someone like Marvin Williams in theory would fit the bill. So that would be on the top of my wish list. And then I would say, you know, a traditional wing, a 3-and-D guy, like whether it's Ariza via buyout or whoever, comes next.
Last subject, and you mentioned his name right there, Trevor Ariza. There's a report today from Mark Stein of the New York Times that the Suns are expected to try to move him once the December 15th date gets here. Of course, they'd like to trade him and get an asset in return. But the trick, as Stein goes on to explain in his subsequent tweets, is that since Ariza is an expiring contract, it's not really going to be easy for the Suns to do that. It sounds easy to sit here and say, well, they won't just buy him out, they'll trade him. Well, the thing is, he's an expiring contract, and there's only a small handful of teams around the league for which Trevor Ariza makes sense. So of those few teams, would they, A, give enough value for an older Trevor Ariza to be worth it for the Suns, and B, would their contracts be palatable enough to where any positive value to them as a basketball player is not offset by the nature of the contract? For example, I know Brandon Knight used to play for the Suns. I'm sure the Rockets, theoretically, they could offer Brandon Knight back to the Suns for Trevor Ariza, and at least from a basketball standpoint, it makes sense to gamble if you're in the Suns' shoes on a 26-year-old Brandon Knight more than a 33-year-old Trevor Ariza. The problem is that Knight has another extra year on his contract that Ariza doesn't, and for the Suns, they're probably better off just letting the contract roll off and reaping the benefits of cap space next summer. So that's why, even though the Suns are expected to trade Ariza, or to try and trade Ariza, I ultimately come out of that report feeling pretty good that he's going to be available via buyout, because I look around at the few teams, and there's not that many that could use Ariza, and I just don't really see a fit. And by the way, even if someone that's not a contender theoretically was willing to trade for Ariza, I can't see the Suns, say, trading him to Atlanta or a team like that, because if they were to get a guy, a veteran, who signed with them when basically it's hard for a team like the Suns to get anyone to sign with them, and then immediately shipped him elsewhere to a bad situation, that would do a lot of damage to their reputation around the league with future free agents and their agency representation. So to me, between the fact that it's not really viable to send Ariza to a non-contender, and the fact that most contenders can't really make the combination of assets plus salary advantageous to the Suns, I come out of this report feeling more optimistic that ultimately they're going to have to buy him out. Is that a reasonable assessment in your eyes?
I think so. I think more than likely he still gets bought out. Now, obviously, you know, if you're the Suns, you'd want to at least hold out hope that one of the contenders is able to either cobble together contracts or facilitate a deal with maybe a third team that can get you a quote-unquote asset. And, you know, we floated one on Twitter earlier around, could we send Brandon Knight a team like the Cavs, they sent a similar expiring contract and a point guard in George Hill to the Suns, and the Suns then send Ariza here. The only reason is that I don't think either Cleveland or Houston really has too much incentive to do that, unless they really believe that competition be fierce for Ariza's buyout service, and as in he was really considering multiple teams. To me, Ariza actually has a great deal of control here. If he wants to kind of indicate his preference and, you know, kind of commit, he could push the Suns to say, hey, let's just move towards buyout. And I think that's what he's trying to do. Now, you know, you get all sorts of leverage and communication through the press as to, like, how the Suns want to do it. But to me, this ends in a buyout.
I think that's more than likely. And, of course, there's no guarantees, even if he's bought out, that he would choose Houston. Now the Rockets, if they want him, they have most of the mid-level exception. That's more than most contenders can offer. But Ariza is from the West Coast. It's very possible the Lakers could have interest in him. So certainly it's not a given. And with the prorated nature of contracts in buyout season, the advantage for the Rockets financially might not be as much as you first think. That said, obviously he's familiar with the Rockets. He's maintained good relationships. There have been reports in recent months that he still has regular dialogue with Daryl Morey. So while I would put the Rockets as favorites, it is important to note that it's not a done deal. But regardless, whether they get him or not, I do think ultimately he's going to be on the market. And the report that Phoenix, even prior to December 15th, is looking to move on from him. Of course, they've got to try for a trade at first. There's no harm in trying. But given the difficulty in terms of assets and contracts matching up, I think the overwhelming likelihood is that ultimately he gets bought out. And at that point, assuming the Rockets haven't found an alternative solution, that could be the guy that the Rockets get, or at the very least need, to fill some of their depth issues. Folks, that's Karthik Prasad. Karthik, thank you so much for the time. If you haven't followed him on Twitter already, I strongly encourage you to do so, at StanfordKP. Karthik, any last thoughts before we let you go?
No, I mean, thanks for having me on, and, you know, I think it's hard for us Rockets fans to be patient sometimes, but, you know, I think there's some good things around the corner, whether it's roster moves or better play, and so we just have to see how this plays out, but I appreciate the time.
Good stuff. That's Karthik Prasad. Again, follow him on Twitter, at StanfordKP, and with the interview wrapped up, this is where we will leave you on this Tuesday evening. Once again, the Rockets do not return to play until Thursday night in Utah. This is their first in a long time to have a multi-day off stretch. The period that ended with last night's 103-91 loss in Minneapolis was a 7-game and 11-night stretch for the Rockets. It feels like every episode I've had lately was a recap of that game. So finally, it's good to have one talking about a few bigger picture items, which I think Karthik excels at. Anyway, now that it's done, I will leave off. As always, until our next episode, if you want more content from me, the best place to get it is on Twitter. I'm on there at Ben Dubose. The show is on there at Locked On Rockets. If there's any formal news about what the Rockets are planning to do with the waiving of Daniel House, are they just converting Gary Clark, or is there an outside signing or trade acquisition? Whatever the case, of course, we'll break it down on Twitter first, and then we'll have the podcast after that. So follow on Twitter for immediate updates, and then beyond that, of course, please subscribe to the podcast if you're not already. Subscribe, leave 5-star reviews. That's how you get the benefit of episodes right when they're out, and we get the benefit of looking attractive to potential advertisers and keeping the business model working here at Locked On Rockets as the most regular podcast covering Houston Rockets basketball. And Stitcher, Google Play, iTunes, TuneIn, Spotify, odds are wherever you listen to your podcast, you can find us, because we're part of a great network of shows, local experts across the NBA, NFL, even some Major League Baseball and college sports here at the Locked On Podcast Network. So at your listening provider of choice, subscribe to us, leave us a 5-star review. Again, that's how we keep the business model rolling and keep everything up and running here at Locked On Rockets as the most regular podcast covering Houston Rockets basketball. Also, in addition to subscribing and following us on Twitter, you should also like us on Facebook if you've not already. We have a Facebook account at facebook.com/LockedOnRockets. Got a website at LockedOnRockets.com if you want to check out our prior episodes. And we've also got an email address, LockedOnRockets@gmail.com, if you've got specific questions for me about the team, suggestions for the show, advertising inquiries, basically anything we can do to make this a better podcast for you, the diehard Rockets fan, or even you, the human being. So with the plugs complete, this is where we will wrap up. Thanks again to Karthik Prasad for joining us. Thanks to you for listening. And please come back soon and listen to more analysis of Houston Rockets basketball right here at Locked On Rockets.